Well, hello there, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast, coming at you from the 25th floor of the Oakwood Roppongi T-Cube residence in Tokyo, Japan. I'm now looking out my window at the most incredible skyline I've ever seen, and boy, am I a happy, happy clam. I'm here in Japan as part of a long world-spanning trip, and I've decided to take just a few minutes out this morning before my next leg of the trip to read to you a little bit from Bruce Sterling's wonderful book, The Hacker Crackdown. But before that, some notes on where I've been in the last couple of weeks since I last recorded one of these. Although you heard one last week, or a little more than last week, actually. I've been a little late on this one. I've been traveling around ever since, and so this is a much-needed update. So I've been in Australia, and I had a great time in Australia. Particularly, I had a wonderful time at a little fan get-together thing. I just put something on Craphound and Boing Boing at the last minute, and thanks to some folks in Melbourne, put together a dinner and drinks at Chocolate Buddha in Founders Square. Had a wonderful time. Melbourne is great, as are the Melbourneites. Melbourne reminds me a whole lot of Toronto in every good way possible. And we had a wonderful stay there, and a lot of great times at the conference, too, at the Melbourne Writers Festival, where I gave, I don't know, 5 talks or something, and a whole ton of press. Before we went to Melbourne, we spent 4 days out in the middle of the Great Barrier Reef on a boat, the Spirit of Freedom, scuba diving. Actually, I was scuba diving. My fiancée, who is pregnant, was snorkeling, because apparently multiple atmospheres of pressure and fetuses don't mix. I actually stayed up top a little and did some snorkeling, but mostly I was down at the bottom diving and having some of the most amazing times of my entire life, swimming with these huge cow rays. And we saw a minke whale, adolescent minke whale that came, was very curious and swam up to us and swam around us and kind of played with us. And oh my God, it was just amazing. But now we're in Japan, where I've already accumulated a couple of good stories. Probably the most funny and terrible one is that I accidentally spent $700 on a pair of trousers yesterday. I bought it with a credit card, didn't really do the conversion from yen to dollars in my head correctly, got out of the shop, looked at the receipt again, realized that those weren't $65 pants, they were $750 pants, went back in and promptly returned them. They were nice pants. I don't think I would have kept them, though. They had all these patent pending warnings on them. They were some kind of nano fabric with magnets built in to hold your iPod headphones. Anyway, they were pretty special, but not $700 worth of special. This has been an incredible trip, as always. This is my second trip to Tokyo, and I heartily recommend it if you haven't tried it. I've never been to a city that is easier to fall in love with than this one. You can check out my Flickr stream for tons of photos from the trip here, particularly photos from the Love Hotel, which was great. If you ever find yourself in Tokyo, go to Shibuya and check into a Love Hotel for an hour. These are themed hotels where you rent by the hour to go and have midday trysts, and the amenities are really cool. You just have to see it. So the food here has been incredible. The sights have been incredible. The shopping has been incredible. The people have been incredible. I'm always struck by how friendly and kind Japanese people are to visitors. Everything has been great. And tomorrow, or today rather, I'm off to Yokohama for the World Science Fiction Convention, where I'll be doing a reading and having a coffee klatch and tons of panels. And I'm also presenting one of the Hugo Awards for Best Novelette. So I'm hoping to see some of you there. And then after that, off to China. First the World Economic Forum Young Global Leaders Summit in Dalian, and then some holiday time in Beijing and in Shanghai. I'm actually going to give a talk in Beijing. If any of you are listening are in Beijing, I'll be at one of the bookstores there, and I'll have more information for you about that online and in the podcast next week or so. And the other thing I'm hoping to do while I'm in China is to get to the bootleg electronics markets and buy lots of different kinds of, say, counterfeit iPods and counterfeit iPhones. My friend Bunny Huang, who broke the Xbox security, tells me that the leading brand of fake iPod is the iPoA, which is just think of the word iPod without the riser on the D. Anyway, I plan on buying a bunch of these things. Apparently they're cheap as anything, and then doing reviews of them. If you were going to buy a fake Linux-based iPhone that ran on any network, which one should you buy? I think that'll be something special. Speaking of reviews, many of you have noticed at this point that Boing Boing has relaunched. That was yesterday. yesterday in Japan. I think it's still today in America. I can't figure it out. The Boing Boing has relaunched with comments and with a new site, Boing Boing Gadgets, edited by the intrepid Joel Johnson. And the response has been amazing, overwhelming. The comments are so good. God, I miss them. And, you know, the only way we could have brought them back was with the able moderation skills of Teresa Nielsen Hayden, an incredible, incredible moderator and editor, and a friend of mine. Other news. Well, I'm starting a radio column for the CBC, so those of you in Canada will be able to hear a little more of my voice. And the other news, the other thing I'd like to mention here is back when I used a Mac, one of the things I really liked was it had a network bridging feature that was really dead easy. You could plug an Ethernet cable in and then make a little Wi-Fi network out of your Ethernet using the laptop's Wi-Fi card. And apparently this is really complicated to do in Linux. It requires lots and lots of steps because, of course, Linux lets you do pretty much anything, including setting up really sophisticated firewalls and so on. I would really like, this is my lazy web request, if any of you out there are serious Ubuntu heads or Linux heads, I'd really like just a script that you double-clicked it and it just said, what would you like to name your network? Will it be open or will it be closed? If closed, what's its password? Click here to make network start. Click again to make it stop again. And that would be it. And it would just take whatever was plugged into Ethernet and make a Wi-Fi network out of it with a DHCPD and all the rest of it. It's been a problem because we've been traveling to all these hotels where there's only one network jack in the room and no wireless. And so we have to fight over who gets the network. And certainly it would improve my marital bliss if there were an easy way to share connections off my Ubuntu laptop. Well, without further ado, let's hear a little of Bruce Sterling's The Hacker Crackdown. There was no question that almost any American hacker arrested would know LOD. They knew the handles of contributors to LOD Tech Journal, and they were likely to have learned their craft through LOD boards and LOD activism. But they'd never met anyone from LOD. Even some rotating cadre who were actually informally in LOD knew one another only by board mail and pseudonyms. This was a highly unconventional profile for a criminal conspiracy. Computer networking and the rapid evolution of the digital underground made the situation very diffuse and confusing. Furthermore, a big reputation in the digital underground did not coincide with one's willingness to commit crimes. Instead, reputation was based on cleverness and technical mastery. As a result, it often seemed that the heavier the hackers were, the less likely they were to have committed any kind of common, easily prosecutable crime. There were some hackers who could really steal, and there were hackers who could really hack, but the two groups didn't seem to overlap much, if at all. For instance, most people in the underground looked up to Emmanuel Goldstein of 2600 as a hacker demigod. But Goldstein's publishing activities were entirely legal. Goldstein just printed dodgy stuff and talked about politics. He didn't even hack. When you came right down to it, Goldstein spent half his time complaining that computer security wasn't strong enough and ought to be drastically improved across the board. Truly heavy-duty hackers, those with serious technical skills who had earned the respect of the underground, never stole money or abused credit cards. Sometimes they might abuse phone codes, but often they seemed to get all the free phone time they wanted without leaving a trace of any kind. The best hackers, the most powerful and technically accomplished, were not professional fraudsters. They raided computers habitually, but wouldn't alter anything or damage anything. They didn't even steal computer equipment. Most had day jobs messing with hardware and could get all the cheap secondhand equipment they wanted. The hottest hackers, unlike the teenage wannabes, weren't snobs about fancy or expensive hardware. Their machines tended to be raw, second-hand digital hot rods, full of custom add-ons they'd cobbled together out of chicken wire, memory chips, and spit. Some were adults, computer software writers and consultants by trade, and making quite good livings at it. Some of them actually worked for the phone company, and for those the hackers actually found under the skirts of Ma Bell, there would be little mercy in 1990. It has long been an article of faith in the underground that the best hackers never get caught. They're far too smart, supposedly. They never get caught because they never boast, brag, or strut. These demigods may read underground boards with a condescending smile, but they never say anything there. The best hackers, according to legend, are adult computer professionals, such as mainframe system administrators, who already know the ins and outs of their particular brand of security. even the best hacker can't break into just any computer at random, the knowledge of security holes is too specialized, varying widely with different software and hardware. But if people are employed to run, say, a Unix mainframe or a VAX VMS machine, they tend to learn security from the inside out. Armed with this knowledge, they can look into most anyone else's Unix or VMS without much trouble or risk, if they want to. And, according to Hacker Legend, of course they want to. And so they do. They just don't make a big deal out of what they've done, so nobody ever finds out. It is also an article of faith in the underground that professional telco people freak like crazed weasels. Of course they spy on Madonna's phone calls. I mean, wouldn't you? Of course they give themselves free long distance. Why the hell should they pay? They're running the whole shebang. It has, as a third matter, long been an article of faith that any hacker caught can escape serious punishment if he confesses how he did it. Hackers seem to believe that government agencies and large corporations are blundering around in cyberspace like eyeless jellyfish or cave salamanders. They feel that these large but pathetically stupid organizations will proffer up genuine gratitude, and perhaps even a security post and a big salary, to the hotshot intruder who will deign to reveal to them the supreme genius of his modus operandi. In the case of longtime LOD member Control-C, this actually happened more or less. Control-C had led Michigan Belle a merry chase, and when captured in 1987, he turned out to be a bright and apparently physically harmless young fanatic, fascinated by phones. There was no chance in hell that Control-C would actually repay the enormous and largely theoretical sums in long-distance service that he had accumulated from Michigan Belle. He could always be indicted for fraud or computer intrusion, but there seemed little real point in this. He hadn't physically damaged any computer. He'd just plead guilty, and he'd likely get the usual slap on the wrist, and in the meantime it would be a big hassle for Michigan Belle just to bring the case. But if kept on the payroll, he might at least keep his fellow hackers at bay. There were uses for him. For instance, a contrite Control-C was featured on Michigan Belle internal posters, sternly warning employees to shred their trash. He'd always gotten most of his best inside info from trashing, raiding telco dumpsters for useful data indiscreetly thrown away. He signed these posters, too. Control-C had become something like a Michigan Belle mascot. And in fact, Control-C did keep other hackers at bay. Little hackers were quite scared of Control-C and his heavy-duty Legion of Doom friends. And big hackers were his friends and didn't want to screw up his cushy situation. No matter what one may say of LOD, they did stick together. When Wasp, an apparently genuinely malicious New York hacker, began crashing Bellcore machines, Control-C received swift volunteer help from the Mentor, and the Georgia LOD wing made up of the Prophet, Ervil, and Leftist. Using Mentor's Phoenix Project board to coordinate, the Doomsters helped telco security to trap Wasp by luring him into a machine with a tap and line trace installed. Wasp lost, LOD won, and my did they brag. Ervil, Prophet, and Leftist were well qualified for this activity, probably more so even than the quite accomplished Control-C. The Georgia boys knew all about phone switching stations. Though relatively Johnny-come-latelys in the Legion of Doom, they were considered some of LOD's heaviest guys, into the hairiest systems around. They had the good fortune to live in or near Atlanta, home of the sleepy and apparently tolerant Bell South Arbok. As Arbok security went, Bell South were cake. U.S. West of Arizona, the Rockies, and the Pacific Northwest were tough and aggressive, probably the heaviest Arbok around. Pacific Bell, California's Pac Bell, were sleek, high-tech, and longtime veterans of the L.A. phone freak wars. 9X had the misfortune to run the New York City area and were warily prepared for most anything. Even Michigan Bell, a division of the Ameritech Arbok, at least had the elementary sense to hire their own hacker as a useful scarecrow. But Bell South, even though their corporate PR proclaimed them to have everything you expect from a leader, were pathetic. When rumor about the LOD's mastery of Georgia's switching network got around to Bell South through Bellcore and telco security scuttlebutt, at first they refused to believe it. If you paid serious attention to every rumor out there about these hacker kids, you would hear all kinds of wacko saucer nut nonsense, that the National Security Agency monitored all American phone calls. Editorial note here, the National Security Agency now does monitor all American phone calls by their own admission. And editorial note, that the CIA and DEA tracked traffic on bulletin boards with word analysis programs, that the Condor could start World War III from a payphone. If there were hackers into Bell South switching stations, then how come nothing had happened? No, nothing had been hurt. Bell South's machines weren't crashing. Bell South wasn't suffering especially badly from fraud. Bell South's customers weren't complaining. Bell South was headquartered in Atlanta, ambitious metropolis of the new high-tech Sunbelt, and Bell South was upgrading its network by leaps and bounds, digitizing the works left, right, and center. They could hardly be considered sluggish or naive. Bell South's technical expertise was second to none, thank you kindly. But then came the Florida business. On June 13, 1989, callers to the Palm Beach County Probation Department in Delray Beach, Florida, found themselves involved in a remarkable discussion with a phone sex worker named Tina in New York State. Somehow, any call to this probation office near Miami was instantly and magically transported across state lines at no extra charge to the user to a pornographic phone sex hotline hundreds of miles away. This practical joke may seem utterly hilarious at first hearing, and indeed, there was a good deal of chuckling about it in phone freak circles, including in the autumn 1989 issue of 2600. But for Southern Bell, a division of the Bell South Arbox supplying local phone services for Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, this was a smoking gun. For the first time ever, a computer intruder had broken into a Bell South central office switching station and reprogrammed it. Or so Bell South thought in June 1989. Actually, LOD members had been frolicking harmlessly in the Bell South switches since September 1987. The stunt of June 13th, call forwarding a number through manipulation of a switching station, was child's play for hackers as accomplished as the Georgia wing of LOD. Switching calls interstate sounded like a big deal, but it only took four lines of code to accomplish. An easy, yet more discreet stunt would be to call forward another number to your own house. If you were careful and considerate and changed the software back later, then not a soul would know. Except you, and whomever you bragged about it to. As for Bell South, what they didn't know wouldn't hurt them. Except now somebody had blown the whole thing wide open, and Bell South knew. A now alerted and considerably paranoid Bell South began searching switches right and left for signs of impropriety, so that in that hot summer of 1989. No fewer than 42 Bell South employees were put on 12-hour shifts, 24 hours a day, for two solid months, poring over records and monitoring computers for any sign of phony access. These 42 overworked experts were known as Bell South's Intrusion Task Force. What the investigators found astounded them. Proprietary telco databases had been manipulated. Phone numbers had been created out of thin air with no users' names and no addresses. And perhaps worst of all, no charges and no records of use. The new digital REMOB, remote observation, diagnostic feature had been extensively tampered with. Hackers had learned to reprogram REMOB software so that they could listen in on any switch-routed call at their leisure. They were using telco property to spy. This electrifying news went out throughout law enforcement in 1989. It had never occurred to anyone at Bell South that their prized and brand new digital switching stations could be reprogrammed. People seemed utterly amazed that anyone could have the nerve. Of course, these switching stations were computers, and everyone knew hackers like to break into computers, but telephone people's computers were different from normal people's computers. The exact reason why these computers were different was rather ill-defined. It certainly wasn't the extent of their security. The security on these Bell South computers was lousy. The AIM-SX computers, for instance, didn't even have passwords. But there was no question that Bell South strongly felt that their computers were very different indeed. And if there were some criminals out there who had not gotten that message, Bell South was determined to see that the message was taught. After all, a 5ESS switching station was no mere bookkeeping system for some local chain of florists. Public service depended on these stations. Public safety depended on these stations. And hackers, lurking in their call forwarding or remobbing, could spy on anybody in a local area. They could spy on telco officials. They could spy on police stations. They could spy on local offices of the Secret Service. In 1989, electronic cops and hacker trackers began using scrambler phones and secured lines. It only made sense. There was no telling who was into these systems. Whoever they were, they sounded scary. There was some new level of antisocial daring. Could be West German hackers, in the pay of the KGB. That, too, had seemed a weird and far-fetched notion until Clifford Stoll had poked and prodded a sluggish Washington law enforcement bureaucracy into investigating a computer intrusion that turned out to be exactly that, hackers in the pay of the KGB. Stoll, the systems manager for an internet lab in Berkeley, California, had ended up on the front page of the New York Times, proclaimed a national hero in the first true story of international computer espionage. Stoll's counter-spy efforts, which he related in a best-selling book, The Cuckoo's Egg, in 1989, had established the credibility of hacking as a possible threat to national security. The United States Secret Service doesn't mess around when it suspects a possible action by a foreign intelligence apparat. The Secret Service scrambler phones and secured lines put a tremendous kink in law enforcement's ability to operate freely, to get the word out, cooperate, prevent misunderstandings. Nevertheless, 1989 scarcely seemed the time for half measures. If the police and Secret Service themselves were not operationally secure, how could they reasonably demand measures of security from private enterprise? At least, the inconvenience made people aware of the seriousness of the threat. If there was a final spur needed to get police off the dime, it came in the realization that the emergency 911 system was vulnerable. The 911 system has its own specialized software, but it is run on the same digital switching systems as the rest of the telephone network. 911 is not physically different from normal telephony, but it is certainly culturally different because this is an area of telephonic cyberspace reserved for police and emergency services. Your average policeman may not know much about hackers or phone freaks. Computer people are weird. Even computer cops are rather weird. The stuff they do is hard to figure out. But a threat to the 911 system is anything but an abstract threat. If the 911 system goes, people can die. Imagine being in a car wreck, staggering to a phone booth, punching 911, and hearing Tina pick up the phone sex line somewhere in New York. The situation's no longer comical, somehow.